So, we're here at Fringe Central before the Fringe officially starts with a new piece from Dyad Productions. And I'm joined by
Elton Townend Jones, director,
and Stephen Cunningham, performer,
and Rebecca Vaughan, producer.
So they're all here. This is getting a bit daunting and we haven't even started yet. And I want to start, whoever wants to take this, with a daunting proposition too, that a lot of shows compromise at the Fringe by shortening them to less than an hour. But some of the best work I've seen, and I've been glad to see it, is that it's been a proper, what I call a proper length. So this piece, before we even go into it, comes in at an hour and a half for good reasons, doesn't it?
Absolutely. This is not the first time we've done a show that is well over an hour. In fact, I think since we did Dalloway, which was our first show, which was 85 minutes, and Jane Eyre, an autobiography, last year, which was also 90 minutes. What it allows, somehow the idea that the Fringe is sort of almost a kind of a small version, a cut price version of the kind of theatre that you can see, we're interested in fully realising some of these really important stories. And actually, only by allowing a full sort of theatre length of an hour and a half, can you really do justice to the themes, to the stories, to what the audience are expecting? And as such, you know, it's not like our ticket prices are more expensive, so it actually becomes a kind of full theatre experience for that kind of same thing. And we've always seen that just because it's the Fringe, it doesn't need to have any less production values or the whole kind of length of the piece needs to be the same length as you would if it weren't at the Fringe. That's pretty much how I think we see it.
By profession, I'm an academic, a writer too, so I don't tend to express my emotions much, but Elton Townend Jones, writer, The Time Machine, H.G. Wells, phwaw!
Yeah, it's a novella I've always liked. I think Rebecca has too, and I think basically we reached a point where we decided that now would be the best time to do it. I think quite simply the last few years of politics in what we call the Western world now has been very surprising to a lot of people, although I can't say I was especially surprised by the turn of events regarding Trump or Brexit or whatever. And the play kind of addresses those issues without saying, you know, this is right or this is wrong, but it does question where we are at the moment and how it is that we treat each other and what it is we leave behind for people we love, but also for people we don't know.
And I'm also, you know, wondering, as you go back in time to such a seminal piece of work that talked about, you know, the future and time travel and shows a, you know, how time changes and changes us as well. You know, how did you get that idea that I'm going to go kind of back in time to deal with issues of today and the future?
I thought it would be a good thing to basically look at it from this point of view. If the world ends tomorrow, or the world ends this afternoon, and yet a Victorian explorer who creates a machine moves forward into the aftermath of that, many thousands of years ahead, and he's able to interrogate what's actually happened and interpret on his own level of interpretation as to what might have befallen man in the many years between his time and our time, and to sift through the remains of that.
And how firm was that idea fixed in your mind when you wrote the script?
Oh, it was incredibly firm. I mean, as with Jane Eyre and Dalloway, I sat down and wrote from a director's point of view. So pretty much what you have is a piece that we can immediately take into the rehearsal room and execute those ideas and those theories straight away.
So go ahead.
I just wanted to very quickly add to that. What's really interesting about Wells's piece as well is that you have this Victorian explorer who is already sort of trying to battle with things that we are still battling with, our place in society, who we are, as Elton said, what we leave behind. And in some ways, that's a really interesting period of time to realise that, you know, 120 years have gone by since that novella was written. And actually, although obviously his own, you know, perceptions of what Victorian men perceived their relationship to society being, actually so much hasn't changed fundamentally about politics and society. And that's also what we can really look into here. If much hasn't changed, you know, if human nature doesn't change that much, how much will it change in the future? Mm-hmm. And I think that's interesting.
But also so much of H.G. Wells' other work was darkly prophetic.
Yeah, I mean, obviously some of that kind of slightly feeds into this, although it wasn't beyond my notice that many of the themes and ideas that Wells creates, such as the Morlocks and the underground tunnels and so on, have been appropriated by other science fiction stories since. I mean, for example, Planet of the Apes, whose t-shirt I'm wearing right now, takes those ideas more than it takes Pierre Boulle's ideas. So what you have is this deeply dystopian and apocalyptic vision of the future that Wells created. Wells was there at the beginning. Wells was able to have his finger on the Victorian pulse, so to speak. And I think the juxtaposition between the Victorian adventurer, whose politics may in a way represent some of the more archaic ways of viewing the world that we still have today, as Rebecca says, go in sharp relief against what perhaps we might like to leave behind in the future, and what we might like to create in the future that benefits mankind.
Going through a performance perspective too, what was your initial reaction when you first read the script?
I was so excited when I first read it. I think we talked about doing it maybe 2-3 years ago almost. It's been a long time in the planning, actually. And when I first read the first draft of the script in January this year, I was just completely blown away by it. I'm a big fan of the original book. I knew it quite well. But reading Elton's script and what he's done with it and how he's the book is there, but how he shaped it in this version is extraordinary, and it was incredibly exciting. Just on a first read, I found myself getting really excited, and I think I cried at one point as well. I can't remember what bit at, but it was just, yeah, it was like, my God, this is going to be such a treat to work on. You know?
In terms of your consciousness and your kind of evolving the characters at work and all of that, where does the original writing and the original book sit in relation to the, you know, the rendered new, very different version that's doing different things too?
Well, I think as a performer, and certainly in the rehearsal room with Elton, of course you're informed by the book and the original, but actually the work you have to do is in the moment with the script that you have. So I certainly haven't found myself going back to the book going, right, is that coming out in what we're doing? You're working with the script that you're going to be performing, essentially. So at some point in the process, you kind of leave the book behind, I think. I still flip back to it occasionally just to go, oh yeah, that's what happened there. But no, it's very specific work in the moment with the script you've got in your hand in the rehearsal room, I think.
What does writing from a director's perspective mean?
It means approaching a text. I guess really it's just the logistics of it. With the model that Dyad Productions has, I know that basically once any given Edinburgh is over, I have to sit down, and if it's an adaptation, work through an original work, take out what Dyad wants to communicate from that piece, and basically focus on a finished work that will be ready for me or any other director, I guess, to approach and take forward. It's knowing that, in effect, as a director, I'm still the writer. It's almost as if the direction, in our case, is an extension of the writing process. I know the unspoken parts of the text. I know what we're going to need and how to derive them from what I've written. I don't need to put everything on the page. It's all there in my vision of the piece, and I take that to Rebecca, and Rebecca looks over that, and we hammer it out and talk it through, and usually we're always on the same page, which is fantastic. Usually I work with Rebecca, and she's fantastic at taking my direction, and we work together as a team. We have a unspoken dialogue between us, and effectively working with Stephen, who's a fantastic performer, and I believe the only person I would want doing this piece, he was made to speak these words and deliver this message. We've had a wonderful working relationship. And so in terms of the writing process overall, it begins with me in a room on my own, working out the logistics of a piece and taking it right to the very end, which is sitting here now in a cafe in Edinburgh, ready to go in 2 days' time.
I was absolutely going to, you've actually said a few other things I was going to say. That I think the way, in many ways, that Elton and I work together with Dyad Productions, that we are we see ourselves not just as Sir Elton being sort of director and writer, but also we are theatre makers. So they aren't just separate things. It's not just writing a play, then just directing a play, then producing a play. We are both absolutely there from the ground up. When I read the first draft, it was sort of me doing a little bit of script editing, and as Elton has done on my scripts. And we are always involved in absolutely every element, from the set design to the costume design to the lighting design and the sound design. We are absolutely it is completely ours. So I think in some ways, when Elton's saying kind of he writes as a director or from a director's point of view, it's because he already knows what it needs to be the piece of theatre we need it to be, if that makes any sense.
But as we sit around this little table here before the start of the Fringe, we've got Rebecca Vaughan, we've got all those shows, we've got, you know, producer, we've got writer in your own right, we've got Elton Townend-Jones, writer, producer, we've got Dyad's way of working. Stephen, isn't this all a bit overwhelming?
Yes, it is. Yeah, I've known Rebecca and Elton for quite a few years now, many, many years, and I've been an admirer of their work since they've started. I think I saw their first production back in 2009.
Yeah.
So when we first started talking about this 3 years ago, I was kind of overwhelmed then that they were even considering me for the part. It was just like, it felt a little bit ridiculous. I was like, it's me? And as the work has gone on over the last 5 weeks, which has been an amazing experience working with Elton, but to be here now, I can't believe we're actually here now and opening in the day after tomorrow.
We're not. It's a hallucination.
Have I done it already? Because that'd be great. No, it's incredibly exciting. It's very nerve-wracking. And it's a big show. And it's a physically demanding show. And it kind of takes a toll, but it's very exciting to do, and I can't wait for people to see it. But yes, it is a daunting prospect, and I am properly terrified.
How did you hold your own in the rehearsal room?
Did I? Maybe that's a question for Elton, I'm not sure. One thing that's been so exciting about working with Elton as a director is how open he is. He gives very clear, very specific direction, but he's very supportive. He allows you to find your own way, or at least try things. They don't always work, of course, but it's a very supportive structure that you work within. And that goes for Elton, it goes for the company as a whole. I feel incredibly supported, not just by Elton and Bex, but by the team they have around them up here, by the lighting design and the sound design. I don't feel like I'm on stage on my own because of the great work that's gone into it already.
And Elson, how do the director and the writer get on with each other?
They get on okay.
But there are dynamics there, aren't there?
There are, yeah, absolutely right. I think, you know, for example, only about an hour ago I added yet another word to the script as a director. But yeah, you're right about the dynamics. I want to hijack this question and just say that Stephen is very humble, but he's a fantastic performer, and he brings a great deal of depth and energy and quality to this performance that I think we were expecting, but he's gone above and beyond our expectations. I tried to... It was Rebecca who cast him. Rebecca said, let's use Steve. And I think my idea for the time travel would be to be part Doctor Who, part David Bowie. And I think we've got exactly that.
You've so got that in the image that I saw for the show.
Yeah.
Fantastic. I'm pleased to hear that. And I think Steve carries that beautifully. If you want to come and see this because you like Dyad, if you want to come because of Rebecca, if you want to come because of me, fair enough. We have the usual team doing the sound and lights, which is Martin Tucker and Danny Bright. But if you really want to see a fantastic performance, come and see Stephen Cunningham. He's brilliant in this show.
In terms of the producing challenge of then bringing that up here to the Fringe, where attention spans are shorter and there's 3,000 shows, and yet we do know your work and we've reviewed it in the past, you know, how do you actually, to use my favourite phrase, hit the ground running?
Well, I think preparation is absolutely key. I mean, I think certainly we learn things every year, which we try and put in place. We try and make sure that our previews are as full as possible, that we're ready to go. I think Elton and I start working on so many aspects of Edinburgh at the same time that we're working on aspects of actually producing the show generally. Edinburgh's an absolutely key part of our working year. I don't think we could exist without it. It is the most perfect way to get a show up and running completely in the bones of the performer, and we can work out what works technically, what needs to be tweaked, what needs to be changed. But I mean, Edinburgh is always a challenge, but I think we've got an amazing, as we were saying, an amazing team, but also our technician that we have running the shows, Kat, who I actually met on tour a few years ago. She was so incredible. We got on so well. And she said, I would love to work with you. You know, if you come to the Fringe, this would be great. And immediately to have someone working with you, not using necessarily a venue technician, but using our own technician who gets to know the show equally in her bones. And in many ways, we see, especially with quite a technical show with a lot of cues, you actually have the technician, the operator, I should say, and the performer almost riffing together, and to make sure they've had enough time before the previews with the tech to actually work on that, and she's got the script and she's going through the script and she's looking at that. These are important things as well. So I think it's just preparation really more than anything. Yeah, definitely.
Coming back to now the relevance of this piece, also why people should see it. You know, C.S. Lewis it was who said that the present is the point at which time touches eternity, and yet that whole kind of new age movement about just living the now. The central character of the time machine, you know, didn't want to live in the now and absolutely wanted to break the rules and go forward. And, you know, other writers like Alvin Toffler, who, you know, wrote the book Future Shock, talk about how an inability to cope with the pace of change is a kind of illness. And I guess you dived as a modern writer right into the heart of all of that.
Yeah, I think so. Stephen and I were only talking early this afternoon about the juxtaposition between the main character, who is definitely itchy and investigative and curious and wants to dig deeper and discover so much about the world. And for anybody who knows the story originally, you know, he makes a great deal of assumptions about the time in which he visits, which prove to be incorrect. Meanwhile, he befriends one of the Eloi, one of the indigenous population of the future that he visits. And there's this wonderful moment where he's investigating the wreckage and ashes of our past, never mind his own, which to him is the future, of course. And while he's doing so, I'm feeling very upset and angsty as he represents the fall of mankind within his own psyche. He looks across and sees Vina, the girl he's befriended, rolling a sea urchin down a case in a museum, completely in the moment, having a wonderful zen-like moment. But it's clear that, you know, if we achieve that zen-like simplicity, it might be possible that there are other people around who would want to eat us, I guess.
If I pulled up a time machine right now and said, Elton, step in, would you?
Based on our show, not necessarily. Someone said to me, can you give me advice for what to take into the future? And I said, yes, it might be a good idea to take a camera, a gun, and a very good coat. But, yeah, I think I might be curious to visit, perhaps, not different times or different epochs, but more personal moments, like visiting grandparents when they were younger or things like that.
And Stephen, in a fully inhabited character as an actor, you do get to experience time travel in this. What's that like?
It's very exhilarating. It's quite scary. It's loud. It's nerve-jangling. But it's very exciting. Yeah, I do it quite a few times, actually. I can't get enough of it. And actually, even, you know, then when you think he's kind of back and you think he's closing off his story, he can't help himself. He's got to keep going. Talk about, you know, not being able to be in the moment. He just can't stand still. He can't be where he is. He's got to be flying off somewhere else. Complete opposite to me. I'd be quite happy to stay at home for the rest of my life. But no, it's Yes, it's a real joy to be able to perform this, because just as a performer, it's very rare you get the opportunity to play the whole gamut of human experience and emotion in the space of an hour and a half. And this play does that. The time traveler's story takes him everywhere, internally, emotionally, while taking him so far into the future we couldn't even imagine. So just as a performer, it's a real opportunity to kind of explore all of that emotional range and test those muscles and see what happens. Very, very rarely get to do that in one piece, you know.
The eyes of the performer light up. And as I give the last question to the writer, because you mentioned Brexit and so on, a little bit more about why this play from a book so old is still so contemporary.
I think Wells was basically asking the questions, what are we doing? Where are we going? Why are we doing the things we do to each other? Are we going to get worse in our relationship? You know, is the future something that we want to take good care of, to nurture, and to nurture our fellow man? Or are we just going to be indifferent and cold and leave each other on the scrap pile, not come to each other's aid? I mean, you know, I may be appropriating a little bit of Dickens in that approach, but I think the question is always going to be perennial. What does the future hold? We want to know. We want the security of knowing things are going to be okay. And I think recently, certainly for Western countries, we've started to think perhaps things may not be so good. There's a lot of doubt. No one's saying Trump is right or wrong. No one's saying Brexit is right or wrong. But we are saying we are in a period of great doubt. And I think that's what this story and this play are all about.
70 years of defying the norm, claims The Fringe. So celebrating 70 years, an hour and a half doesn't seem so long then. So come and see The Time Machine. It's about time this came to The Fringe in this way. Thank you very much.
Thank you.